I'm Anthony Brooks in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lawyers for the Bush administration appeared in federal court today and spoke under oath for the first time about the destruction of CIA videotapes that showed suspected terrorists being subjected to harsh interrogation practices. The Bush administration wants the judge to hold off on any inquiry into the tapes, arguing that would disrupt a joint investigation by the Justice Department and the CIA. Months before the CIA destroyed the interrogation tapes in 2005, the judge who demanded today's hearing had ordered the government not to destroy any evidence of mistreatment or abuse of suspects being held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So among the questions dominating Washington today, who in the Bush administration knew what and when did they know it? Also at stake, how deeply will a federal judge appointed by President Clinton weigh into this matter? Joining us now from Washington is Carol Lenig, D.C. courts reporter for The Washington Post. And Carol, welcome.
Thank you.
Let us know, first of all, why this judge demanded this hearing. What did he want to know?
The judge felt, obviously, by scheduling the hearing, that he had to hear the two sides on whether or not there had been some violation of his 2005 court order, insisting that evidence of any abuse, mistreatment, or torture of detainees in Guantanamo be preserved as evidence. And that's appropriate, completely appropriate. What the judge heard today were the two sides arguing, the government and the detainees' lawyers, arguing about whether or not, essentially, the government should be trusted now to say that they have been preserving this evidence and carefully keeping it about Guantanamo detainees when they've now confirmed that they destroyed tapes of interrogation, including likely waterboarding techniques on two detainees who were not at Guantanamo at that time.
Hmm. So lay out the Bush administration's case today. What did it argue specifically?
It argued two key points. One, that the court should not weigh in to this matter, should not start holding a hearing when the Department of Justice is inquiring right now into whether or not a crime was committed in the destruction of the tapes and whether or not that destruction or any other actions were inconsistent with other court orders. They say that a court inquiry would essentially ruin or compromise the integrity of that separate criminal inquiry with which it should have precedence. Second thing they argued was that there is no way that the destruction of the CIA tapes taken outside of Guantanamo from start to end in 2002 had any relationship to the court's order.
Right, and they argued that because those were tapes of two suspects who were being held overseas in secret CIA prisons, not at Guantanamo Bay, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's Abu Zubaydah and Mr. Nashiri.
Right.
And again, they argued today that all of that information, all those interrogations were in 2002 from beginning to end, so they can't have any relationship to the 2005 order. But what's interesting that the detainee counsels argued, or the lawyers for the Guantanamo detainees argued, was that trusting the Justice Department now to get to the bottom of this matter, after the Justice Department may have been involved in advising whether or not the CIA should destroy the tapes, is like trusting, to quote David Reams of Covington and Burling, like putting the fox in charge of the hen house.
Hmm.
He also argued that the inquiry that the court needs to make goes beyond the CIA tapes, and it has to go to the issue of, is any other evidence that's relevant to Guantanamo detainees really being preserved, or are we going to later find out that some other interrogation tapes were destroyed with some partial knowledge of the administration lawyers?
What was the mood in the courtroom? I gather there was some real tension between the lawyers for the detainees and the government lawyers.
The tension was really in the stakes, the verbiage, if you will, the body language, a lot of tension, because it's not a pleasant thing when a plaintiff's lawyer is arguing, and it's very rare, by the way, when they're arguing that evidence has been destroyed. And lawyers for the government, in the person of Joseph Hunt, argued they take that allegation very seriously. It's like saying, you know, you're a chef and you put a bunch of botulism into the soup. It's one of the most weighty and concerning allegations you can make to a lawyer for the government.
Mm. Finally, Carol, this all happened in the courtroom of U.S. District Judge Henry H. Kennedy. He was appointed by President Bill Clinton. What ways might he rule? What are his options? How did he respond to the arguments today?
Well, he asked today a lot of things that were slightly dubious of the plaintiff's, the habeas counsel's petition, or rather their claims. He said, should he really weigh in here? Should he really get involved now when it looks like the CIA tapes don't have to do with Guantanamo treatment? And one of the things he can do is ask the department, he mentioned this, so the Department of Justice report back to him on what they find. The Assistant Attorney General who's leading the investigation, Ken Weinstein, is a former U.S. attorney who the judge knows well and probably has a lot of faith in. He can also order that there be a limited inquiry and that the court take questions to key people about whether or not evidence that's relevant to his cases and that he ordered in 2005 be preserved, whether that was ever destroyed.
Hmm. Well, Carol, thanks so much for keeping track of this story for us today, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Carol Lenig. She is D.C. courts reporter for The Washington Post. Is America in danger of embracing the idea of political dynasty? Well, maybe. Consider that we've had presidents named Bush or Clinton for about the last 20 years. And if Hillary Clinton is elected president and wins a second term, that would mean the White House would be occupied by Bushes or Clintons for nearly 30 years. Does this make sense in a country that fought and won a revolution to free itself from a king? Is there something un-American about this? The conservative Republican activist Grover Norquist says yes. He's calling for a constitutional amendment that would bar family members from following each other directly into political office. In fact, the tradition of political dynasties dates back to the beginning of the nation, starting with father and son presidents John Adams and John Quincy Adams. And among the current top crop of presidential candidates, besides Hillary Clinton, there's Mitt Romney, the son of George Romney, a former governor of Michigan, who also ran for president. To discuss this and other political issues of the day, we're joined by historian Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and editor of the upcoming book, Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s. And welcome, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. According to The Economist magazine, 100 million Americans have never known a president whose name isn't either Bush or Clinton. In your view, is this a good thing for the country or a bad thing?
I think it's not the best thing that, you know, a generation of Americans might have only voted for someone from one of two families. But I don't think we're in danger of some kind of dynasty politics or some kind of politics where we undermine some part of the Constitution. But there is some, you know, danger in that we lose a variety of ideas in the public realm.
Do you think it's something that Americans are concerned about? I mean, how concerned should they be?
Well, ultimately, it's not really a dynasty in that, you know, both people have to get elected. George W. Bush had to ultimately get elected, and so will Hillary Clinton. So there's some check that I think Americans realize in the system. And currently, the problems Hillary Clinton's facing in New Hampshire and Iowa are an indication that name is not always a guarantee of victory. And sometimes your name can cause problems. So I think most Americans might be a little worried about it or not worried about it, but I don't think they see any crisis. I think they're a lot more concerned about bread and butter issues or the war.
Mm. And it's true, and it's sort of a tempting thing to talk about dynasty. On the other hand, Bill Clinton grew up very humbly from a broken family. He became president. Not long ago, we had a peanut farmer named Jimmy Carter who seemed to come out of nowhere and become president. I mean, is this still sort of the American way, I guess, that people can rise and take the reins of power?
Yeah, we still have that opportunity. And obviously, Bill Clinton is just a classic example of that. But I do think there is an issue raised by both the Bush and Clinton success, and that is the amount of money that is needed in the political system to do well. And part of what you're seeing is that name recognition just makes it easier to raise vast amounts of funds quickly, the kinds of funds that are needed in the primary system that we now have. And so I think the dynasty issue is less important than the fundraising issue and the issue of private money in elections, which I think this is also part of.
Hmm. You hear the phrase that anyone can grow up to be president, and I think what you're talking about, the needs for vast amounts of cash, and this is a need that seems to grow with each election cycle, that seems to sort of work against that sort of old, quaint idea that just about anybody can grow up to be president.
Sure, anyone can grow up to be president theoretically, but if you really want to run and you really want to do well, it sometimes helps to have either a name, a family, or some kind of connection to the world of industry or to the world of politics that will get you the massive amounts of funds that are needed. It's a lot harder to just start from nowhere and to really break into the system, and I think that's just a fact, and it's pretty hard to dispute, even though we have some exceptions of people who rise to power, but by the time they're ready to run, even Bill Clinton, those connections are pretty well formed, and they have a certain capacity to raise the money that's needed.
Mm. Can anything be done about this over-reliance on money? This seems to be an issue, a perennial issue that comes up every election cycle. I remember John McCain back in 2000 getting a lot of mileage talking about campaign finance reform. Laws get passed, and yet the money, it's like water. It finds a way through the dam. And is there anything that can be done?
It's very hard. Look, we've had public financing laws since Watergate, since 1976. For a while, they did work, and candidates adhered to the limitations on private funds in order to receive public funds. In the recent cycles, people have just abandoned the public money so they can raise all they want. So if we impose the public money and the limitations that come with it, that would certainly help. The second thing is voters. We often blame the interests. We often blame kind of amorphous forces. But ultimately, if voters go to the voting booth and vote in high numbers and punish those who we think are corrupt or who we think rely too much on private money, I think that could influence politics as well.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the current presidential campaign. And speaking of Hillary Clinton, she's campaigning with her husband pretty forcefully now. And I'm wondering if you think how much this helps her today. For example, today in The Washington Post, there was a piece that sort of indicated that when they appear together, Bill gets more attention than Hillary does. Is this helping her or hindering her chances?
I think overall it still helps her. I mean, she has really developed her reputation by this point. She's not an unknown person either in Washington or in New Hampshire. So it's not as if she's an unknown then being supported by a famous husband who steals all her thunder. I don't think that's the case. So I think overall he's just added value. I mean, he brings people out. He motivates people to vote and to give money. And he generates a certain excitement about a Clinton White House that overall I think is better for her than not having him appear at all. I think Al Gore learned the lesson of abandoning someone who's very popular in politics, and she's learned from that. And so I think this is a benefit, and this is really a neck-and-neck primary. So she needs everything she has to get those people out.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, we were let's stay with the presidential race. We started this conversation with concerns about political dynasties, but in fact, this is a pretty rare election in that there's no sitting president running, no sitting vice president running. Are there any historical parallels to be drawn to past presidential elections?
Well, in 1952, Truman had dropped out, and we had Adlai Stevenson facing off against Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower emerged, I would say, as a much more popular and strong Republican figure by the time we got to Election Day than we might see from the Republicans at this point, and maybe the Democrats. So it doesn't happen that often. It's happened in the past, but when it happens, it creates a certain amount of uncertainty and chaos in the campaigns that leads us to, you know, last-minute switches in voter preference, because there is no strong preference for Democrats or Republicans at this point. And so that opens up the race.
Mm. Well, speaking of switches, I'd love to talk to you about a couple of trends we're seeing. Rudy Giuliani in national polls, and in particular, seemed like the prohibitive front runner for a while, and now he's dropping. What explains this, in your view?
Well, I mean, I think with the Republicans, there is no solid person who is liked very much. I think whoever is introduced quickly moves to front runner status and then falls rather quickly. We've seen this with Thompson. We've seen this with Giuliani. And it's not impossible we'd see this with Huckabee. So there's a certain amount of unease within the Republican Party right now about what the Republican Party should stand for and about the candidates who are going to run, that it gives this kind of fluctuation. And Giuliani has always been a bit of an eccentric Republican. He's a liberal Republican in an age of conservatism. On most issues, he stands to the left of the party. And personally, he has a personal story that's controversial and also allegations of corruption from New York that just make him a very tenuous candidate at best. So it's not that surprising after some euphoria and interest that his ratings could fall as people looked at the other guys.
Well, sticking with Republicans, Mitt Romney has been polling pretty well in Iowa and in neighboring New Hampshire. But some controversy has tripped him up this week. He said he saw his father march with Martin Luther King. In fact, that turns out not to be true. Romney says he made the claim in a figurative sense. That is, he meant that his dad supported King and the civil rights movement. What's your reaction to this as a historian and to this kind of claim and to how serious this kind of trip up is for Romney?
Well, I mean, it depends what his intention was. But if it really was just a trip up, just a mistake, we see this all the time in campaigns. I mean, this is one of the things that seasoned candidates learn either not to do or once they make a mistake like this to really move forward fast and in an aggressive fashion. That was what Bill Clinton did in 1992. So I don't really think this is going to be, an end of the campaign issue for Mitt Romney. And I'm not sure how serious it was that he made this mistake. I mean, I think overall it's not central to what his candidacy is about. And I think really this is just a test of him moving forward and sticking to his plan.
Mm. By the way, the Boston Herald and the Boston Globe, both of Romney's hometown papers, have endorsed his rival, John McCain, in the New Hampshire presidential primary. Again, we know that editorial endorsements don't always add up to a whole lot, but significant that these are two papers from his home state.
It is, and it does point to an issue he'll face certainly in a general election, in that Massachusetts will become a key part of his election campaign and his run for the presidency. That's what happened to Michael Dukakis. I mean, if he does become the Republican candidate, and even as the primary seasons progress, people are going to look very closely at his record in Massachusetts, find all the opponents of his time as governor, and bring back all the problems that he faced when he was leading this state. And that's something he's going to have to be prepared for. And those kind of endorsements are just a signal, a sign that not everything was right in Massachusetts when he was governor. And I think that's one of the people focus on religion with Mitt Romney, but people should also focus on Massachusetts. I mean, that will be the way in which many people evaluate what kind of president he would be.
Hmm. I want to just go back to the Democrats for a second, because I'm really curious to what you make of, you mentioned earlier in the last segment that Hillary was beginning to hit some obstacles, Hillary Clinton. Barack Obama seems to be giving her a real run for her money suddenly, and they're sort of competing, you know, Barack Obama, the agent of change, Hillary Clinton, the agent of experience, if you will. How do you think that's going to play out as we go forward?
Yeah, I think you're capturing it perfectly. I mean, the attraction of Barack Obama is a certain form of anti-politics. It's a tradition in the Democratic Party, a promise of change, a promise of a new style of politics. Often, though, voters in the end don't vote on those issues. They're much more interested in what you're going to do for the economy or what you're going to do to get us out of a war or into a war, depending on your perspective. And there's always a certain amount of nervousness about anti-politics politicians. So I think that's something he's going to have to wrestle with in the coming weeks. And Hillary Clinton is a pragmatist. I mean, she comes out of the tradition of pragmatic liberalism. And what's hard about that is it's not particularly appealing in speeches. It's not particularly appealing to the hearts of voters. But many voters can find that attractive in the final days when they're thinking, who can actually beat a Republican in 2008 and who would be the best person in office to work with a narrowly divided Congress, which is likely what we're going to have.
Hmm. We have about 20 seconds left, but what do you make of the issue, the big issue for a while, the war in Iraq? Now we're seeing polls that Americans are less concerned about that and returning to, surprise, surprise, pocketbook issues.
Yeah, I think the economy is certainly competing with the war, if not trumping the war. And I think this is a big opportunity for Democrats during the primary, but after the primary. It's an area where Republicans have been much weaker. And Democrats, though, have to capitalize on it and think of one or two issues that can really show that Democrats would actually do something different and more effective come 2008 to heal the economic ills that face the nation.
Mm. Well, Julian Zelizer, what a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. That's Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's also editor of the upcoming book, Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s. And this note about next week, we look back at a Christmas Eve during World War I, when British and German soldiers put down their guns, came out of the trenches, and played soccer. As we enter the holidays and the final days of 2007, journalists often look ahead and ask, what's in store for the new year? That's what our colleagues at The Economist magazine have done. They've published a special edition entitled The World in 2008. It was edited by Daniel Franklin of The Economist, who joins us now. And Daniel, good to have you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, it's a great edition. There's lots in here, from U.S. domestic politics to Iran and Iraq to China and Venezuela. But let's start with one of the big domestic stories of 2008 here in the U.S., and that is that it will be the final year of the Bush presidency. And in it, the Economist writes, 2008 is likely to be a year of profound stasis. Why stasis?
Well, of course, you have in effect, lame duck president and a Democratic Congress, so that's hardly a recipe for getting anything done. And I think the focus will be on the election rather than on any legislative program that the president might like to push through. Having said that, I think it's interesting, seen from outside, it's a very different President Bush that we're seeing now compared with certainly his first term and even the beginning of the second term. He's actually much more consultative. He's making some progress in North Korea, for example, may even be a chance of some progress in Iran this year, who knows. So it's rather a different president just as he's leaving, and we would, I think, see many Europeans pleased to see a change in the White House, but funnily enough, the way that President George Bush is now acting as president might not be all that different from the way that his successor behaves.
Hmm. Well, speaking of the successor, the new president will be inheriting a war in Iraq. In the view of your editor, is there an end in sight to this war? How is that going to shape up in 2008?
I don't think there's a chance of an end being seen in 2008, so it's certainly a problem that he's going to bequeath to his successor. And even then, I think it's not going to be a quick process because the security situation on the ground will remain very complicated. And, of course, there will be a need to bring in other powers, other regional powers, Western allies as well. So it's going to be a particularly tricky, complex situation for the next president.
In the magazine, Peter David writes that 2008 signals an opportunity for Iran and the U.S. to explore a possible grand bargain. What's the magazine referring to here?
Yes, it's not so much a prediction as an exploration of what a grand bargain might look like and what the interests of the two countries might be in looking at it. And one of the interests is that the alternative is so dreadful to contemplate. The idea of an actual military showdown between the United States and Iran is a terrible option for both countries. So there may be an interest to look to see whether there could be some sort of accommodation. And actually, if you look at the past, the two countries have put out feelers to one another. They've just never put them out at the same time. So there's never been a basis for the two to negotiate. Whereas now, perhaps the idea that this is the least bad of all options to consider might push them towards some sort of an agreement, a recognition of each other's spheres of influence in the Middle East, and a way forward both on the nuclear question and on, for example, policy towards Iraq.
There's also the question of Israel and Iran's stance toward Israel. It's hard to imagine, at least listening to the rhetoric and the way it's come out of Washington in recent months and years, that there really could be this kind of cooperation.
They have cooperated with Israel. Iran has cooperated with Israel in the past. It may be that this particular president, Ahmadinejad, would have to be put in his place in some form. His own domestic situation is a little bit wobbly at the moment. So it's not impossible. I don't think it's perhaps the likeliest of things, but it's not impossible to contemplate that one of the surprises of 2008, if you like, might be an accommodation between America and Iran.
All right, let's move on to China. There's a big section in your in this edition of The Economist on China. China, of course, will be on the world stage because of the Beijing Olympics, August 2008. What's at stake for China?
Well, the Beijing Olympics is often called China's big coming out party. It's an occasion when, as you say, it'll be in the spotlight. It'll have the world's attention. And it's its chance to show how far it's come, how much it's developed. And it is an impressive story. At the same time, in 2008, China will be the country that contributes most to global growth. It'll overtake Germany as the world's biggest exporter. It'll overtake Germany in the sheer size of its economy. It'll be behind only the United States and Japan. Less gloriously, it'll be overtaking, if it hasn't already done so, the United States as the world's biggest polluter. So in all these respects, China is just becoming more and more important. So the Olympics is just, if you like, the moment where all this comes together. People start focusing in a big way on how much China matters. And it's a tricky thing for China to manage, because people will also be focusing, of course, on China's domestic politics, its human rights record.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you. Yeah. Does the fact that China will be so prominent on the world stage because of the Olympics, does that mean there'll be an opportunity to encourage it to behave differently on these issues, like human rights, for example? Or does it mean that China becomes almost more defensive with a sort of global spotlight on it?
I think a bit of both. I think we've already seen that opportunity taken up, for example, over a campaign coming out of Hollywood with regard to China's behavior in Sudan. So there has been pressure already put on China, and China doesn't want anything to spoil the party. So there is a chance to try to put pressure on China. At the same time, as you suggest, I think China will be defensive, will try to do the minimum that it has to do to keep the show on the road for the Olympics, but not change its fundamental policy direction. It's a tightrope. Remember, there'll be journalists swarming over Beijing. That's not something that's particularly comfortable for the Chinese authorities. Probably demonstrations of some sorts in the streets to draw attention to, let's say, problems in Tibet. I suspect in the end what will emerge is a successful Olympics, a few small concessions here and there, but China's fundamental policy remaining unchanged.
Finally, let's return to the U.S. You have an essay entitled After the Binge, and this is about the U.S. economy. And the first sentence reads like this: crudely put, the fate of the American economy next year will be determined by three F words: foreclosures, foreigners, and the Fed.
Well, yes, foreclosures, of course, refers to the terrible problems in the housing market, and we're going to see more of that. And there is great speculation as to whether the United States economy will move into recession in the first half of 2008. If it's not an actual recession, I think it'll feel very much like one. And the hope to avoid an actual recession does come from, first of all, the Fed, its ability to stimulate the economy by lowering interest rates. And secondly, yes, from foreigners, because countries like China, growing very fast, creating demand for U.S. products. And the dollar, of course, is relatively cheap now compared with, say, the euro. So U.S. exports should be very competitive, and indeed they are growing quite strongly.
Well, Daniel Franklin, thank you so much for talking about 2008 with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And that's Daniel Franklin. He edited a special edition of The Economist magazine entitled The World in 2008. You're listening to Here and Now. Okay, time now to talk a bit about the world of sports. It's been a little over 1 week since former Senator George Mitchell released his report, and Major League Baseball is still talking about the performance-enhancing drug scandal. More names have come out in affidavits. More players are weighing in on the issue. The College Football Bowl season has begun, and in the NFL, the Patriots' chances of going unbeaten look better than ever. Here to talk about all the news from the world of sports is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, good to see you, as always.
Anthony, a pleasure to join you.
Okay. And Bill, fallout from the Mitchell report. Yesterday, an affidavit was unsealed in federal court that said home run hitter Sammy Sosa talked about using amphetamines. Today, ESPN is reporting more names linked to performance-enhancing drugs. Is this going to be the pattern, more names being thrown out a little bit at a time?
Well, more investigations means more people trying to protect themselves and get immunity from prosecution, and that probably means more names coming out. So, yeah, I would think we, especially if Congress gets involved and there are more investigations, I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
So more to come. Meanwhile, we mentioned that players are weighing in. Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling, a man not known, not famous for his reticence, has weighed in and said of Roger Clemens that he needed to clear his name or surrender his 128 Cy Young Awards or whatever it is he's won.
Yes.
Does he have a point?
Well,
what's going on here?
Not famous for his reticence is a very kind way to put it, I think. I think that we can close the door on the issue of steroids in baseball now that Curt Schilling has weighed in. How about if we just leave it at that?
Right, and presidential politics as well, correct? Yeah. Okay, moving on. But seriously, is news about steroid and human growth hormones, is this going to have an impact on the way fans look at this game? For instance, are people going to stay away from the ballparks the way they did after the 1994 strike?
Anthony, I can't see any reason to think that that would be the case because the Barry Bonds story has been going on for years. People have been saying, well, Bonds, there's this terrible feeling he's going to break the most, sacred record in all of baseball, and everybody's saying he's dirty with steroids and everything. Baseball had its most profitable year ever during the time that all of that hullabaloo was going on. So I really can't see how the implication or even the demonstration and the confessions from players who have apparently used steroids or human growth hormone is much going to stop baseball from continuing to be very successful on a financial basis.
Moving on to college football, that yearly ritual back with us, bowl season, 32 games in 20 days that leads up to the BCS national title game on January 7th, which will have Ohio State meet Louisiana State University. And this has been a strange season. Usual football powerhouses like Michigan lost to Appalachia State. A sophomore wins the Heisman Trophy for the first time. Are the bowls going to sort of clarify anything for us?
Well, my feeling has always been that the function of bowl games is to provoke rather than resolve controversy. And so I'm in favor of as many unresolved questions as possible once football ends. And, of course, that's diametrically opposed to all the people who think that football should have a playoff system and that the final championship should happen on the 4th of July.
Okay. All right. We'll look forward to that. And sticking with football but moving to professional football, we almost had this weekend a matchup of two teams with perfect records. Perfect but opposite records. The undefeated New England Patriots against the hapless Miami Dolphins. And wouldn't you know it, Miami goes and wins a game.
Miami didn't read the script.
They didn't read the script.
Ravens didn't either. And Miami finally won a game. It's awful. It would have been great fun to have a totally beaten team face a totally unbeaten team at that point in the season. I root for stories, and that would have been a great story. And now the only great story left is to see whether the Patriots finish up 16-0.
And what do you think? There's a pretty good chance of that,
right? I think there's a very good chance, although, as you are well aware, every once in a while you have injuries in pro football. And the Patriots, like all other teams, are, vulnerable to injuries.
Okay, we've been talking about the world of sports with Bill Littlefield, host of Only a Game, who joins us every week here on Here and Now. Bill, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
Coming up, the story for Mara. It's a mother's Christmas gift to her daughter about the story of her life as a political refugee. That's next up, Here and Now. Amidst the holiday season's shopping frenzy, parents often struggle to find appropriate gifts for their kids. Brazilian-born Nadejda Marques came up with a fresh idea about what to give her daughter, Mara. She wrote her a book, and this is her story about how it all came about.
Dear Santa Claus, if you have time, I would like these days. Everybody to be happy, a very good book, and a present for Mom, even though she doesn't believe in you. I like you very much, Santa Claus. Love me, Mara.
That's my 7-year-old daughter, Mara, reading her letter to Santa. Mara's first wish is for everyone to be happy. Then she would like a good book. Mara knows I'm writing a book about my life, and she knows she has to wait until she's older before she can read it. Right now she thinks the book is an excuse I use when I don't want to play with her. It's not. I'm writing the book for her, so she can know who she is, who we are. I don't talk much, Mara. It's not that I'm shy. I'm a survivor. And the first rule of survival is silence. My father was murdered when I was 10 months old. In Brazil, I had to burn my photographs and letters and leave clothes and toys behind each time we were forced to change houses. I had to pretend not to know my friends when I saw them in the park. Silence is the first rule of survival, Mara. The second rule is that certain things are best kept to yourself.
Mommy doesn't believe in Santa, and she read the newspaper, not Papi and not me. And she doesn't believe in Santa, so that's why.
Jim, Mara, and I are just home from Logan Airport in Boston. I still get nervous when I pass through customs. We spent the week at a human rights conference in Mexico City. At the airport there, I read Mara's newspaper article about how someone had stolen Santa's laughter and how Santa was sad. She knows I don't believe in Santa, so she made me stop and give the paper to her father. She thinks the news will have a happier ending if he reads it. I never heard my father read to me. On January 8, 1973, when I was 10 months old, my father was abducted from the bookstore where he worked in Recife, Brazil. He and five other so-called subversives were taken to a farmhouse, tortured, and killed. These were os anos de chumbo, Mara, the Brazilian years of lead. 5 years earlier, the military had seized power in a coup. "If you notice anything," my father told my mother on that last morning, "if I'm late, if I don't come home, just run away. Take Nadezhda and run away." When my father didn't come home, my mother cut her long dark hair, dyed it blonde, and boarded a bus for Rio de Janeiro. Then she took a train to Chile. 6 months later, I was on a plane for Santiago with a forged birth certificate and a distant relative who pretended to be my grandmother. We found my mother in the squatter settlement on the outskirts of Santiago, stockpiling food for winter and a civil war that seemed inevitable. The coup came on September 11, Mara. September 11, 1973. Presidente Salvador Allende was killed. After weeks spent wandering the streets of Santiago, we managed to flee to Sweden and found asylum as refugees. A local newspaper published an article about me, the youngest refugee from Chile. I was 1.5 years old. Jim and Mara are playing tackle-tackle in our living room as they watch a football game on TV. They row and wrestle on the floor and pretend they are the New England Patriots on their way to another Super Bowl. I used to dance in front of the television in Havana, Mara. We moved from Sweden to Cuba in May 1974. I was 2 years old. Cuba seemed a paradise to me. My mom met my stepfather, and I had many new aunties and uncles, refugees whose real names I never knew. Aunt Nadine was my favorite. She let me play with her plastic arm. She'd lost her real arm when a grenade exploded in her hand. At night, they would sing me to sleep with protest songs, like the ones I sing to you. My family moved back to Brazil in 1979, when I was your age. I didn't like it. My stepfather was a union organizer and was constantly harassed and arrested. We moved around a lot and had to be careful who we spoke to. I was 25 when I met your father. Jim was an American human rights lawyer working in Brazil. In a year, we were married. 3 years later, you arrived in Rio de Janeiro on August 28, 2000. I was frightened. My past still haunted me. How could I possibly keep you safe? But with your eyes, you said, "Don't worry. Everything will be all right, Mama. Everything will be all right."
Daddy, ask me about baseball.
What is it called if you hit, if there's someone on every base and you hit a home run?
I know that.
What's it called?
Mara's childhood here in the United States is so different than mine. We walk the same streets every day to school. We're not afraid of being followed. We talk to strangers while waiting in line at the supermarket. My daughter loves baseball and bossa nova. She can read and write in English and Portuguese. At bedtime, I tell her a story. At first, I told her fairy tales. After a while, I thought it would be easier to tell her stories that were true, but it isn't. I was 23 years old the first time I met my father, Mara. I found his name in a book, a dossier of people killed or made to disappear by the dictatorship in Brazil. There were hundreds of victims, Mara, hundreds of stories. I spoke each victim's name out loud, and after each name I said presente, present. José Carlos Novaes da Mata Machado, presente. José Manuel da Silva, presente. It's an old ritual from the resistance, Mara, to show that the dead and the things they fought for are still with us. Jarbas Pereira Marques, my father, Mara, the one who made me, and us. Jarbas Pereira Marques, presente. The first rule of survival is silence, Mara. The second is that some things are best kept to yourself. But now these things belong to you as well. Feliz Natal, Mara. Merry Christmas.
Debulhar o trigo, recolher cada favo do trigo, forja do trigo, milagre do pão, e se fartar de pão.
Nadejda Marques lives with her daughter Mara and her husband Jim in Cambridge, Massachusetts. To learn more about her memoir, Born Subversive, go to our website, here-now.org. Nadejda Marques' story was produced by Ken Schulman. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.